Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin with Simon Schuster, Abigail Walls. Little rush on this Labor Day weekend, Working Man. First time you've heard this song, right, Simon?
First time in my life.
You know what? That song was probably 20 years old by the time you were born, just so you know. But it's a great song anyway, and I like to haul it out just for Labor Day. And later in this podcast, we've got the president of the AFL-CIO, Ron Bieber, is going to be joining us. But first, guys, we had some news this weekend regarding straight ticket voting. And we know that it looks like we are still going to have the straight ticket voting oval still on our ballots come November, unless Schuette, you know, is able to pull some kind of judicial miracle. But Simon, let's talk about after November. What is going to happen after November in regards to this court case? And did the dissent that we saw out of the appellate court this week give us any clues?
Yes. Dissent from a Reagan-appointed judge is actually only about 2 pages long and only addresses the procedural issues that he didn't like. He thought that it should have had review en banc with all of the judges on the Sixth Circuit. However, his appendix to his dissent is 6 pages long and essentially throws the defense a bone by kind of picking apart the plaintiff's argument ahead of time and saying why the district judge should have never granted this injunction in the first place. He cites that 40 other states have this law, and perhaps that when this goes to trial, this is the, you know, he sort of charts the course for how the defense is going to argue this case. He brings up the sort of Voter Rights Act categories that have to be met for it to be considered an actual disparate impact. And he also, you know, he speaks about the 40 states that do not have straight ticket voting and how their bans have been upheld.
Abby, let's talk about this, because we have heard before from the folks who want to keep straight ticket voting here that Michigan is special somehow, that we are not like the other states, that for some reason this has become part of our nomenclature. Talk about this argument a little bit.
Really, I mean, one thing that was brought up at NCSL, National Conference of State Legislatures, earlier this year was the issue of straight ticket voting and how straight ticket voting in states that don't have it or have the option to vote cross-ballot has really gone down over the last 10 years. So when it comes to straight ticket voting, there's nothing illegal about split ticket voting itself. It's just, how are you changing the environment of our voting procedure? Are we meeting the criteria of the Voting Rights Act that makes this not an encumbrance to voters to go vote? I mean, that's really the main thrust of this, is are you changing the voting system in such a way that doesn't disenfranchise certain voters or all voters or whatever? That's really what the issue is here, is the procedure going forward changing the voting.
And what's interesting to me as well is that this is being cast as a civil rights matter. And the most recent big trial that Michigan has had in this regard is DeBoer v. Snyder. And in that, you know, the main crux of the trial was the question of, do the children of same-sex parents have the same outcomes as the children of heterosexual parents? And they get really bogged down in the methodological weeds of the reports. Now, in granting this preliminary injunction and also in their success in the appeals court, the plaintiffs have really relied upon this report by Kurt Metzger. And when this goes to trial, I think we're going to see that picked apart in perhaps minute detail.
And what does that report say, the Metzger report?
He analyzed the populations from 9 different counties, and he said that this was representative of the state of Michigan. And he basically, the conclusion that he came to is that if straight ticket voting is eliminated in these heavily black, heavily urban areas, that the lines will be increased and that voter turnout will then, as a result, be depressed.
Interesting. We're going to speak with Ron Bieber about this a little later, about his experiences at lines in Michigan. I think it's fair to say, though, that our ballots are fairly long in this state. And in the city of Detroit, for example, they're also going to be voting for school board this time around. And you know that in Detroit, those lists for people running for offices can be very lengthy to get through. And there's no straight ticket voting in that option. Those are all nonpartisan races. When it's all said and done, guys, are we going to continue to have the straight ticket voting oval on the ballot in 2020, 2018? Simon, will we have the oval, yes or no?
For the moment, I would say leaning towards no, only because of the precedent that's garnered here. But I think that, you know, there is always room to blaze new judicial territory. I think it's just a question of whether or not the plaintiffs can present a convincing enough argument that warrants that.
I know you want a short answer here, but no matter what state you look at, voting in urban areas, in dense areas, is a problem for voting. Lines are always long in urban areas. It's tough to get people to the polls and have enough polling locations and keep it cost efficient. So unless we somehow come to a compromise where we have no excuse absentee voting and you create other ways to vote that are more adaptable to people's schedules and will reduce lines, I really don't think we see it just that box is going away.
So you think that, yes, we will have that oval in 2018 and 2020?
Yeah, I think it's going to take other political compromises. I mean, it's not a secret that Republicans don't particularly like no-excuse absentee voting. And unless you can come to that compromise, I don't think you're going to see much of a change.
I think I'm going to side with Simon on this. I like your arguments, but I'm going to also agree that we will not have the oval in 2018-2020. Just again, my personal opinion on this is that if you take a look at where the courts have been, I think across the country, and I understand Michigan's different and whatever, it's part of our heritage and our history and people are used to it and whatnot. I think that the courts in the end will side with states' rights on this, and if the state wants to change the ballot, I think that they're going to be, you're giving me a funny face here. I just feel like at the end of the day, the state is going to be able to determine what they want to do and how their ballot looks.
I'm just going to say, if someone at the Secretary of State wants to tell me how many ballots come in where someone fills in the straight ticket voting and proceeds to vote across the ticket, I would just love to know how many ballots come in like that where people fill in the top oval and then think they'd have to keep on going. I think that would indicate how people really view this kind of thing.
I mean, once you're at the nonpartisan section of the ballot, it's always pretty dicey. The Third Judicial Circuit, for example, there's going to be 24 names on that list, and that's going to be no small task for any voter.
Hmm. All right, well, let's move on to the next part here. Insider or outsider? It's interesting that in this particular race for president, we have the insider running against the alleged outsider, Abigail. But in some of these state legislative races, it seems like there has been an emboldening attitude toward candidates running as an insider.
You know, back of the napkin count of candidates on both sides of the aisle that have either worked as staff in Lansing or are married to someone who works in Lansing, I get about 12 names out of that. I think this is interesting. In 2010, you couldn't be further from Lansing if you tried, and that was how you got elected. And now we're seeing people, you know, talking to people who are saying, I have institutional knowledge, I know how the system works, and this is now a credential that just 6 years ago was the third rail of getting elected. I think it's absolutely fascinating and, you know, kind of indicates a sort of shift in attitude towards governing in Lansing, you know?
Or maybe it's just that people are more convincing in their arguments that having an insider in a term-limited environment is of benefit.
Yeah.
You know, as before, you know, those folks who were embedded in the whole Lansing culture and we continued to get the same old quote-unquote cronies running things who were tied in with the lobbyists and they were feathering their own bed is now gone away because we don't have any of those folks anymore. But now we have folks in there who maybe don't have good experience or enough experience to know what's going on. So we need people with experience to keep the ship upright.
Yeah, it's like the pendulum swung the other way now that House has been cleaned with people who weren't term limited. And we've been going like this for a couple of sessions now. It's kind of like, oh, well, I guess we need at least somebody who knows where the pens are kept.
I think that as long as you've got a candidate who is compelling and good at the doors, and I'm thinking like, let's say a Sylvia Santana or a Ben Frederick. I mean, somebody who really connects well, mm-hmm. you know, at the doors, you can make any kind of argument, really. I mean, I wonder if that's fair to say,
yeah.
You know, because you can make the good argument that, you know, we need the outsider to come in and shape this ship up. Or you can say, you know what, there's a real experience gap in this town, and I can come in there, fill that gap, and be more effective as your representative filling that gap.
Yeah, you make a good point there. I'm not sure that it's something that people are leading at the doors with. Like, hi, I've worked in Lansing for this many years, and this is why you should elect me. I mean, most down-ballot candidates succeed by just being people like to have on their doorstep. But I just think it's interesting that it's something that's publicly spoken about. There
right.
aren't euphemisms
yeah.
for, you know, I have public service experience. No, you're saying I was a staffer for this guy, this guy, this guy, and this guy. And you're like, oh, that's refreshingly honest.
Right. And I think one of the people that we're talking about here is Sneller in the 50th District. This guy's been a staffer for years and years mm-hmm. and has segued that now into a very successful primary race. He's not going to have a general election much to speak of. He's going to be the next state rep in the Genesee County area. Mm-hmm.
I don't think you can really overestimate the extent with which the top of the ticket has kind of helped precipitate this shift. Mm-hmm. When you look at Donald Trump, he's sort of traversed the fourth political dimension. He is the insider-outsider because he's bucked the Republican trend completely of, you know, not acknowledging the influence of super PACs, of Citizens United. And he's been open in saying that these things have an enormous influence on politicians and their campaigns. This is completely unprecedented for the Republican ticket. And his conflation of this business and political worlds has kind of presented him as someone who has good acumen because he's saying that I was on the business side of this equation. I was was influencing the politicians. Now I can be the one who's advocating for you. And it that has, at least throughout the primary stages, brought him traditional success. Even on the Democratic side of the ticket with Hillary Clinton, she's very much the resume candidate. When you look at the Democratic National Convention, it was a litany of people attesting to her credentials and her experience and how much policy knowledge she would bring to the table. And I think that, like, just from that, we're going to create a considerable amount of churn in terms of these narratives of being an outsider or an insider, because it completely turns on its head the notions of whether these things are good or bad.
I think I'm going to have to get the dictionary out and so I can understand some of the words you just used there, Simon. But I do think you bring up a good point, though, too, on the outsider-insider thing on Donald Trump. And I also wonder, too, for those people who just have a complete distaste of Donald Trump and see him as an outsider, has he tainted the well now for outsiders to some degree? You know, because now he has presented himself as an outsider, even though that he is also an insider. Can other people say, oh, yeah, I'm an outsider, too, but now that Trump has laid claim to that, I don't know. Has he tainted the well?
See, I feel like the leading question there, because of how unpopular Trump is in general. I mean, if anybody's going to poison the outsider well, it's probably Senator Ted Cruz. I mean, he's for the longest time been the person who stopped anything from getting done for any state, up to and including the Flint water crisis. But so I don't know that it's that simple of a metric.
Okay.
What I really think is interesting here is, you know, some of these trends usually start bottom up, and seeing at a down ballot level this sort of return of critical thinking skills, that if I want to elect an effective legislator, I should probably vote for somebody with experience or who knows what they're doing when they get in the door. I think that's an interesting trend maybe to watch for the next 4 years.
So is it better to be an outsider or an insider? It depends on the cell, but no longer is the insider a poison pill.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
All right. Well, with that, guys, let's turn it over to the interview portion of the podcast. Joining us this week is the president of the AFL-CIO here in Michigan, Ron Bieber. Thanks for joining us on the podcast again this year.
My pleasure, Kyle. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's go first of all about the state of labor here in the state of Michigan. How do you see the state of labor compared to years past and going forward?
Well, I'd say strong and getting stronger. We actually added members in Michigan last year, 36,000 new members that we gained over the year before. Some of that is due to, obviously, President Obama. Thank you, President Obama, for his help in rescuing the auto industry. And auto industry is back stronger than ever before in Michigan. Michigan's an auto state. Some of it's because of construction with the economy. There's construction going on and new members coming in that way. But I will say growing stronger because of all the legislative attacks that union workers and all working people have had from this legislature over the last six years, people are figuring out that they're better off when they stand up and speak up together.
Do you think the Republican legislature has hit a breaking point as far as legislation that impacts organized labor? I'm thinking back to the repeal of the prevailing wage. You know, that was such a hot issue last year, and it hadn't seemed to go anywhere.
Yeah, they really struggled. I mean, two times they tried last year, and it was a disaster for them both times. Whether they've exhausted their list or not of bad things they want to do, I don't know. If I was them, I would leave prevailing wage alone. We'll see where they go on that one. The indication has been that they don't want to take it up. I would throw caution to the Republicans that labor will get energized and mobilized like never before if they try again to take away prevailing wage. That's a bedrock labor issue, and people are just not going to stand for it.
What do you make of the Republican Party here in Michigan? It seems to be getting more conservative. Is that a fair observation? Is that one you share?
I think a conservative observation is getting worse than more conservative, I think. You know, years ago, there were lines that neither side would cross. Right to work would have been a line. Even when the Republicans, when John Engler was in power, I suspect he would have liked to take on right to work, but they didn't do it. It was a more civil time, and those lines are all gone now. I think some of it's got to do with the Tea Party pushing the Republican Party way to the right. And I'd say that legislating in this state is in a sorry condition right now.
Now, during the primary, we noticed that there were some sections of organized labor that supported Republicans during the primary process. Is that an acknowledgement that there are still some Republicans who are sympathetic to some of your issues?
Yeah, I'd say absolutely. And let me be clear on this. We endorse some Republicans from the AFL in the primary. We aren't necessarily a Democratic institution. We will support any legislator, Republican or Democrat, who supports us in our issues. We're supporting the Republican in the state house in the general election. We care about labor issues and we'll work with any legislator from any side who will work with us.
So you have endorsed a Republican in the general election?
We have.
Is it a safe district?
No, not necessarily. Well, it's a safe Republican district,
okay.
Relatively safe. It's the third. He actually is a union member also. He had five Republicans in the primary, I believe.
Which one?
Jeff Urich is his name.
Jeff Urich, yeah.
He's a firefighter.
Kasperson up in the first district wasn't successful. Some of the pushback that we got after the primary was that if unions hadn't gotten involved, maybe Kasperson would have won.
Maybe. Labor's kind of split around Tom Kasperson. Some of the affiliates of the AFL are really close to Tom Kasperson. Some are not. I don't know if labor, I don't want to say that we helped Tom Kasperson or didn't help Tom Kasperson. Tom Kasperson, I'll have to answer that for you. But I think we've got a strong candidate on the Democratic side, a good friend running Lon Johnson. So,
who do you think is the Democrats' best chance to pick up a congressional seat this go around?
Well, I'd say either Lon Johnson in the first or Gretchen Driscoll in the seventh. Both of them are friends of mine, friends of labor, and great candidates. They'd be great congresspeople. Either one of those, I would think. Tim Walberg is so far out there and way too conservative for his district. And Lon's just he's a good guy, and he'd make a great legislator, and he'd always be on the side of working people.
Now let's talk about the issue everybody wants to talk about this election, which is Donald Trump. And Donald Trump seems to have a lot of support in northern Michigan, and he does well in some rural areas. Does that make it harder for Democrats to win down ballot because of his presence?
Well, we'll have to see. Let me give you a secret here. The secret answer, Donald Trump is not going to win Michigan. He's just not. He does have pockets where he's doing better than what I think he should be. Is it going to make it more difficult? We'll have to see November 8th how he stands. I just can't see him holding out the support that he's got now. Every day he does something to lose support, and I think he'll do that, and we will be successful.
Now, what do you make of Donald Trump's support for revisiting NAFTA, saying no to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, being stiff on the trade deals? That's something that appeals to a lot of your members.
Yeah, at face value it would, but our members are smart people, and we're going to work every day between now and November 8th to make them even smarter. Donald Trump talks tough on trade, but when he's had his own business dealings, he didn't do what he should have for working people in this country. He could have made ties, he could have made shirts, he could have made suits in Michigan, but he chose not to. He chose instead to go to Mexico and Bangladesh and China, so he may talk tough, but our members are smart and can always see a con man coming, and they're going to figure out Donald Trump in a hurry, I think, and we're going to help them do that.
That's kind of a line of attack you guys used against Dick DeVos back in 2006. Very similar, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It was the same issue. DeVos said one thing, but in his own business dealings, he did business in China when he could have did it in Michigan, or more in Michigan anyway. I think that's why Donald Trump keeps coming back to Michigan, because the only thing I don't think he's got anywhere else to go, and trade is the one issue that he thinks he can play in Michigan, but it's not going to work.
Let's talk about straight ticket voting. The Court of Appeals on the federal side has said that they're not going to accept Schuette's appeal for an en banc review of the straight ticket issue. Is it time for Schuette to give up the ghost on this one?
Yeah, absolutely, Kyle. They've played this out as far as they can, and it's time to move forward. We should be making it easier for people to vote in Michigan, not harder. Twice before, the legislature's tried to take away straight party voting, and the citizens put it back in play. It's time for Bill Schuette to realize that that's the way people in Michigan want to vote, and just let it go.
Now, one of the pushbacks that we've heard on this is that people should be told to vote in every single race, and that it's not necessarily going to increase lines. What's been your experience as far as long lines or any kind of lines at voting booths?
Well, let me just say this. When they vote one box instead of going down the entire ticket, those voters are making a choice to do that. So in effect, they are voting every box. But I can tell you in 2012, I worked in Detroit, and that was where I did my election day work and visited probably 12 districts. And the lines in Detroit that day, the shortest I came across was 3 hours, and 4 hours was common. So if we didn't have straight party ticket voting, then those lines would be maybe 6 hours. And people shouldn't have to stand in line 6 hours to be able to vote. We should be making it easier for people to vote and not harder.
3 to 4 hours people were waiting to vote in the last presidential election.
Absolutely.
In the city of Detroit.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they were willing to do it.
Yeah, they stood there, and it was not a great day. It was cold, and a lot of them had to stand in lines outside, and they stood there to do it. Our Michigan people take their voting rights seriously, but nobody should have to stand in a line that long.
What's your predictions on what's going to happen in the state house races this year?
Let me say it this way. I believe there is a tough but a winnable path for the Democrats to win majority. It's not going to be easy, but there's a path there to do it. One of the reasons it's not going to be easy is because the Republicans have manipulated the rules to their favor, gerrymandered the districts so that there's less and less competitive seats, doubled campaign contributions so that they can get even more money from billionaire friends like Dick DeVos. So in my opinion, they've manipulated the rules to their favor. But when you've got a governor as unpopular as Snyder and Donald Trump at the top of the ticket, and after all the attacks that this Republican-led legislature has done to working people, I think there's a path that the Democrats could win majority.
You've mentioned before that Donald Trump will not win this state. How much of a margin do you see Hillary Clinton winning by? Are we talking 5, 10%, 15? Is this going to be a blowout?
It's hard to say. She's going to win, and I think she's going to win relatively big. I don't want to give a number, but we've got a lot of time left, and Trump will screw himself up every day between now and the election, and Hillary Clinton is the most qualified person ever to run for this office. She's on the side of working people, and I think the people in Michigan will realize that.
And then the last thing I wanted to talk about is lame duck. What are you guys hoping for lame duck, if anything?
Well, I'd hope it comes and goes quickly, and I'll tell you why, honestly. If we're going to pick up seats in the Democratic seats in the state house, maybe we get to majority. If we get to majority, I can see Dick DeVos and others like him putting a lot of pressure on those Republicans to do everything they can before they lose majority. I would throw a word of caution to people like Bill Schuette and Brian Kelly. The ones who are over in that legislature, a lot of them who are going to be taking those votes, won't be around. People are going to mobilize and energize. They've had enough now with these attacks on working people. The ones who are going to be left are looking to run for office in the future. They'll be looking to take it out on somebody. And if I was some of those folks, I'd be spreading the word to my colleagues, don't do this to me. So my hope would be that cooler heads prevail, and it's a short session and a reasonable session, and that it not be a vindictive session.
And just to kind of close on that, Governor Snyder has not been very acceptant about repealing prevailing wage. Do you hold him to that? Do you think that he's good on that?
I would like to say yes, but we all know what happened with right to work. So he's not been good about standing up to pressure, and we'll see. I would caution the folks on the other side. I wouldn't mess with prevailing wage. You will poke a hornet's nest the likes that you won't see. That is a bedrock issue to labor, and we're not going to stand for it.
Ron Beaver, he's the president of the Michigan AFL-CIO. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Bottle of frozen water out of the freezer. I think it's been in there for about 7 months. I think it was here when Lauren and Craig and maybe even Emily was still around. How long will it take for this bottle of water to de-thaw? This is like a 16-ounce bottle of water. Or ice.
This is trivia. All right. Any mathematicians out there?
What do you think? I'm thinking maybe by 4 hours?
Yeah, 4 hours would have been my guess.
Well, is that right? Okay, we're on the same wavelength. Plus or minus 4 hours.
I don't have the patience to wait 4 hours for water. Or I guess I'd say 4 hours sounds about right, but get yourself a glass of water.
I don't like drinking that tap water.
But BWL works so hard.
I know they do, and I shower with it, and I cook with it, and whatever, but I would rather... I'm a water snob.
Just get a filter, Kyle. It's much cheaper.
I guess. Maybe there's... Okay, maybe someday. Maybe someday. I'll get one of those fun devices that they shipped up to Flint there. We'll take water right out of the air and make you a nice cup of water.
Yeah, that water will give you superpowers now.
I'll expense it. Can you imagine? Can John get that bill? I bet you I get called up in the office for that one, huh? I'll keep you all informed if that trick happens. But until then, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.